You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And it is Friday, so it is time for Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us, taking your calls in our national town hall meeting. Senator, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
It's great to have you here. Before we get started, I wanted to correct something I said last week and apologize to you for this. I will be very careful not to do this in the future. I quoted Antonin Scalia to you saying essentially words the effect of, I can do whatever I want as a Supreme Court justice. And it was an accurate quote, but what he was – the context was wrong, and I didn't know that at the time. His context was he was making fun of a Supreme Court justice who would say such a thing rather than asserting it himself. So my apologies. But in any case, where are you? What's going on? And what are your thoughts on the state
of
politics?
I'm in southern Vermont now. And obviously my thoughts, almost everybody else's in the nation, is on the coming election. And its enormous importance to the future of our country. And Tom, one of the concerns that I have, and what drives me a little bit nuts, is how media covers politics in America, which makes it look more like an American Idol show or an amateur hour show and a singing show rather than a show looking at what the candidates stand for and how it's going to impact this nation for our kids and our grandchildren. So the debates are important, and obviously Obama did a lot better in the second debate than the first debate. But the truth is, what these guys stand for, what their policy positions are, what parties they come from, is far, far more important. And I hope that everybody understands that what we are seeing in America today is a major political party, the Republican Party, which has become a very right-wing party. And that is Mitt Romney's party, and he proudly accepted their nomination. This is a party which absolutely, and this is what the Paul Ryan budget is about, and Ryan is obviously Romney's vice presidential nominee. What the Ryan budget is about are tax breaks for the wealthiest people in this country and massive cuts in Medicare, that is transforming our Medicare system away from what is right now into a voucher system, horrendous cuts in Medicaid such that 14 million Americans would be cut off of Medicaid over the next decade because they're cutting $770 billion. Now you tell me what happens to a working person today, maybe a mom with a couple of kids who's now on Medicaid, and when she's cut off, what happens to her? Where does she get her health care? These guys want to abolish and terminate the Affordable Care Act, which was going to expand health care to another 30 million Americans. These guys want to throw not only adults off of Medicaid, but children as well, about 1.7 million kids, if the Ryan plan were to become a law. At a time when so many of our young people can't afford college or are graduating deeply in debt from college, they want to cut Pell Grants to about 1 million lower-income students by a cut of some $200 billion. They want to cut 2 million kids off of the Head Start program. So what the Republican Party is about, and I wish the media would focus on it, it really is not complicated. This is a party which now stands with the wealthiest people in this country, people who are doing phenomenally well, people who, as Warren Buffett reminds us, are paying a very low effective tax rate, which is what Romney's tax rates are about, because all of the loopholes and tax breaks they receive today. And this is a party that wants to give these people even more tax breaks, despite the growing wealth and income inequality in America. And then, in order to balance the budget, they want to go after Social Security. They want to go after disabled veterans, cutting benefits. They want to go after nutrition programs. They want to go after health care programs. They want to go after educational programs. And we as a nation have got to say, no, that is not what America is about. We're not going to make the wealthiest people wealthier and really stick it to tens of millions of our neighbors who are struggling to keep their heads above economically. Now, have the Democrats, and I know there's a lot of disappointment out there, because people say, well, where are the Democrats? Have they been as strong and tough as they should be? And the answer is, no, they have not. And let me, as an independent, longest-serving independent in congressional history, make that clear. They have not. But I think people with maturity understand that Obama is the much preferred candidate in this election. And the day after the election, our job is to put as much pressure through a strong grassroots movement on the president to say, Mr. President, stand with the working families of this country.
Yep.
Be prepared to take on Wall Street and the bankers there who have caused so much pain in this country. Be prepared to fight for new trade policies, which will prevent corporations from shutting down plants in America and moving to China and other countries. Be prepared to help us rebuild the infrastructure and transform our energy system, and in doing that, create millions of decent-paying jobs. Because while we do have to deal with the deficit in a way, in my view, that is fair, we also have to create millions and millions of jobs to address the unemployment problem in America today, which is not at 7.8%, but is closer to 15% if you include those people who have given up looking for work and people who are working part-time. So what we want to do, I think, is in this election, in my view, and I'm working very hard on this, is to defeat right-wing extremism and at the same time move forward to demand that the Democratic Party be more vigorous in standing up for working families.
Yeah. And what are you seeing on the ground? I mean, you're out there right now in Vermont. I mean, you're out there talking to people. There's all this, you know, all this kerfuffle about all these different topics that are being debated in the presidential debates.
Well,
and things. What do you think it all boils down to?
I don't know that I have anything profound to tell you, Tom, that your listeners haven't heard elsewhere. It's going to be a close election. That's what I know in Vermont, unless I'm very mistaken. Obama is going to do very, very well. I am 10 minutes away right now as I speak to you from New Hampshire, and that state is up in the air. There are a lot of states, Virginia, Iowa, North Carolina, Ohio, where these elections are very, very close. Yeah. And I hope that all Americans, and especially the people in the so-called battleground states, understand that, yeah, Obama is not a perfect candidate, and the last 4 years have been far from perfect. But given the enormous differences between the Republicans and Democrats and Romney and the president, there is no question that we have got to reelect the president with as big a vote as we possibly can. But this is going to be a very, very, very tough election and very tight election.
Yeah.
And I hope that people do everything they can to get their friends and family out to the polling booths in many states, as you know. We have early voting. People can vote on Monday. And I hope that that they do.
Yeah, and make sure that you know, if you show up in person, you can find out if one of these companies that the Republicans have hired that are changing Democrats' addresses and things so their votes get bounced, that you know, make sure that you're actually registered the way that you're supposed to be registered.
Well, one of the really shameful, honest people can hold different points of views. And in a democracy, that's what happens, and I respect that. But that you have in a number of different ways, Republican governors, legislators, and operatives literally trying to suppress the vote. That is vulgar. I mean, that is so anti-American that I don't know where to begin. We have people in this country, who have fought and died to defend, the American Constitution and our way of life, and that you have Republican operatives trying to keep people from being able to cast their ballots is beyond disgusting.
Well said. Senator Bernie Sanders is with us. He will be taking your calls next in our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie, right here on the Tom Hartman Program. 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You can check out Senator Sanders' website, by the way, at sanders.senate.gov. Ours is tomhartman.com. You can drop into our free live chat room and say hi. We'll be back with more with Bernie right after this.
We have not come thus far without a struggle, and I assure you that we cannot go further without a struggle.
There you go. It's a struggle. Welcome back. And one of the great people out there fighting the great fight every day, Senator Bernie Sanders, taking your calls right now in our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie. Dave in Merrillville, Indiana. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes. Good morning, Senator Sanders and Tom. I was wondering, you keep hearing the Republicans all the time saying this is the worst recovery, from a recession that we've ever had. And why don't the Democrats ever explain, I don't hear the president, anybody else explain the reason why, because in past recessions, most of what we buy was made in the United States. So the money stayed in this country, creating more jobs. Now most of the things we buy is made in China, so the money is going over to China, creating jobs in China.
Well, Dave, that's, I think, a very important point to make. I think in defense of the president here, sometimes with media, it is very hard to make a case in a six-second soundbite, which is often what you see on TV. But I think let's do this, and let's back up 4 years ago and remember exactly where we are, where we were at this particular moment. Remember that. And I sometimes get disturbed that I think people forget it. They have a little bit of amnesia here. And that is, in terms of the recession, we were at a moment in history where we were hemorrhaging 700,000 jobs a month. That is an unbelievable number, unbelievable number. 4 years ago, people were beginning the process of losing their homes. The stock market was plummeting. People were losing their life savings. So you had massive unemployment. You had people losing their homes and their life savings. And on top of all of that, because of the deregulation of Wall Street, something which I very strongly opposed, the crooks on Wall Street had driven us into a position where not only the American financial system, but the world financial system stood on the verge of collapse, such that you could put your plastic card into an ATM machine and you might not get any money out because the system would be completely collapsing. That is where we were. Are we in a great spot now? No. Everybody knows that. Unemployment is much too high. Median family income has gone down. Too many people still lack health insurance. Too many of our people are still working two or three jobs. Everybody understands that. We don't need Mr. Romney's lecture to tell us that the economy is in rough shape. But we do need Mr. Romney to understand how we got into this position right now, and the fact that while we're not creating as many jobs as we would like, it's a lot better to create 100,000 jobs a month, not a great job performance. It's a lot better to do that than to lose 700,000 or 800,000 jobs a month. And it's also important to know that after all is said and done, the Romney economic plan is exactly what the plan of George W. Bush was about. And that is more tax breaks for the rich, more unfettered free trade, which is Dave's point. I think the point that Dave is making is that right now, as a result of our disastrous trade policies, when we go out and buy products, we are not necessarily putting fellow Americans back to work, certainly in the manufacturing sector, because everything being equal, those products come from China or someplace else. And that's because we passed these disastrous trade agreements. And I got to say, Romney wants us to accelerate that process, make it easier for companies to shut down in America and invest in China. That is exactly the wrong direction. And last but not least, Romney is a big proponent of more deregulation, which seems to me to be absolutely insane when you talk about Wall Street, because it was the deregulation of Wall Street, the fact that Congress allowed a situation against my vote, very strong opposition, to see investor banks merge with commercial banks, merge with insurance companies, and that is the kind of deregulation that Mr. Romney wants. So I think you're looking at a situation where Romney will take us economically back to Bush and those policies which led us to where we are right now.
Larry in Canton, Michigan. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Larry?
That's you, Larry. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah. I'm sorry. As a left of liberal, I'm having a hard time trying to figure out why this election is so close. But I'd like to proffer something here, and it has to do with the tax the rich mantra. A lot of middle class people who are working more than one job, they equate success to wealth and riches. And maybe in the back of their minds, they're saying to themselves, why should I work so hard? Why should I work so hard to attain success when the government is just going to take more and take more, not realizing that they are not in the position with wealth and riches? And that is really my main point. I'm just wondering if that could be one of the small reasons.
Yes. Larry, I think that's a good point. And, in my view, if we're going to deal with the deficit in a serious and fair way, you don't do it on the backs of the elderly, the children, the sick, and the poor. You do, in fact, ask the wealthiest people in this country to start paying their fair share of taxes. Now, your point is that there are a lot of people who think, they're going to be going after me. But that's really not the case. I think in terms of, and we have to do a better job in making that clear. For example, Romney wants to extend Bush's tax breaks for all people, including people making $250,000 a year. Meanwhile, he wants to transform Medicare and make devastating cuts to Medicaid. And what the American people have got to understand, if we are going to get out of this deficit situation, which we should, we are going to need more revenue. And poll after poll, I should say, Larry, makes it clear that the American people do believe that millionaires and billionaires who today are doing phenomenally well, whose effective tax rate is quite low from an historical perspective, should be asked to pay their fair share so we don't have to cut Medicaid or transform Medicare into a voucher program or cut Social Security or cut veterans programs. People understand that. But you are right in saying the Republicans have done a pretty good job in making the average American feel that if you cut taxes,
you're listening to the Tom Hartman program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Sorry, Bernie. Finish your thought.
That's about it.
Okay. We'll be right back with more of Senator Sanders right after this. Welcome back. Brunch with Bernie here, our national town hall meeting with Senator Bernie Sanders on the air with us. And, Bernie, you're still here with us?
I'm right here.
Okay, great. Carol in Apache Junction, Arizona. You are on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Thank you. Most everybody's talking about the middle class, and there's no mention of the poor class. I was grateful you did recently. We're out here and we vote, too. And I guarantee you all my Social Security check goes into the community. The last two winters, I've been fortunate enough to benefit from LIHEAP. I believe that's the Low Income Household Energy Assistance Program.
Yep.
I was told there was no money for it this year, and I suspect that since the monetary matters originate in the House, that I have the Republicans to thank for not having that funding this year.
Well, Carol, thank you very much for asking that question. In my state of Vermont, it gets pretty cold in the wintertime, so LIHEAP is a very important program for Vermont. And I'm happy to tell you that a few years ago, I led the effort to double LIHEAP funding from $2.5 billion to about $5 billion. But in the last few years, that has been chipped away and chipped away. So the issue is not that there will be zero funding for LIHEAP. That is not the case, Carol. The issue is whether how much funding there will be. And there is no question that many of our Republican friends, but I have to tell you some Democrats as well, are prepared to cut LIHEAP. So we are going to do, as Vermont's senator, I can assure you that I am going to do everything that I can to make sure that nobody in America goes cold this winter. That's not what our country is about. Most of the people who get LIHEAP are seniors or they are children. They are families with young kids. So we're going to do our best to make sure that LIHEAP is adequately funded. But it is not true to suggest that there would be zero funding. We doubled funding a few years ago. It has been chipped away. We have to make sure that funding is adequate to protect all people throughout this country this coming winter.
Vincent in Newmarket, Maryland. You're on the air with Senator Sanders. Vincent?
Hi, Senator Sanders. My name's Vincent. I'm from New Market. Thank you for your service, and I'd like to thank also Senator Todd for his courage and Senator Frank for his consistency and my senator, Senator Sikorski, for just being her. My question is, do you think that we will ever get back to get back to Glass-Steagall? Do you ever think we'll be able to return banking back to what it should be, and that the financial sector has, I know the term had enough, is not appropriate here, but to return the financial sector to some sort of normalcy instead of continuing to prey upon us? And my other question was, how many senators do we need to have a filibuster-proof Senate? Thank you.
Okay. All right, Vincent, thank you very much for asking two excellent questions. One is more policy, one is kind of more process and political. In terms of Wall Street, you ask, is there a chance that we can restore the regulation that we used to have? Before, by the way, Vincent, listen to this. Wall Street spent $5 billion over a 10-year period on Republicans and Democrats in order to get deregulated. And I remember that very well because I was a member of the Financial Services Committee. I remember all the fights that I had with Alan Greenspan and others who were telling us just how great it would be if we just deregulated our friends on Wall Street and allowed them to become bigger and bigger and bigger. The answer as to whether we go back to Glass-Steagall, something that I support, although I would go further, has everything to do with this election and politics in general. Certainly, if Mr. Romney is president, you have heard him talk about deregulation, deregulation, deregulation. That is not going to happen. They will move in the opposite direction. Hopefully, if Obama is reelected, hopefully we can get enough support to say we never want to be in a position again where a handful of huge financial institutions are able to bring this economy to their knees because of their greed, their recklessness, and their illegal behavior. What I would tell you, Vincent, is I would really go further. And ironically, there are some conservative economists who agree with me. And that is, when you have today six of the largest financial institutions in this country having assets equivalent to $9 trillion, two-thirds of the GDP of this country, that is a recipe for too big to fail once again. And in my view, we've got to break these huge financial institutions up. And we do have to return to a situation where banks actually lent money out to homeowners and small businesses and medium-sized businesses, i.e. worked with the productive economy to help us create jobs rather than maintaining the world's largest gambling casino, which is what Wall Street is today. In terms of your question regarding the filibuster, that is an issue that a number of us in the Senate are keenly concerned about. We think it is absurd that the Republicans have been more obstructionist than at any time in modern American history, where they are doing everything they can to force 60 votes on virtually every important piece of legislation. So some of us are looking at a variety of ways for filibuster reform so that while the minority continues to have important roles to play, it is not the minority that runs the Senate, but the majority.
Carson in Vienna, Virginia. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
All right, thanks. All right, bye.
Carson?
Hey, how you doing? Good to talk to you, Senator Sanders. My question really resides around kind of the campaign and Citizens United. I think it's pretty bipartisan that most people feel that there's way too much money in this election cycle as a result of Citizens United. So my question is, how come the Democrats and Obama in particular not campaigning more on what he would do or attempt to do to try and either overturn or blunt Citizens United? To me, it seems like a no-brainer platform to run on.
Carson, I agree with you. I think you make an excellent point. You know, as somebody who has introduced a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United, I think you're quite right. I don't think this is just a Democratic issue. I think you got a lot of Republicans out there who are saying, is American democracy really about one family, such as the Koch brothers, spending $400 million in this election? Is democracy about Sheldon Adelson, one person, spending $100 million? Is that really what people fought and died for? So I think you do have a lot of bipartisan support that says, let us overturn Citizens United. Now, some of Obama's people were talking about the fact that the president was thinking about this, but I absolutely agree with you. I think the president should be absolutely forthright and say that if reelected, he will work with Congress and work with the states. We now have 9 states on record saying that they want Citizens United overturned, because no matter what your political view is, I think most people do not believe that a handful of billionaires should be able to buy and sell politicians or buy and sell elections. So, Carson, I absolutely agree with you and believe the president should be much more forthright on that issue.
James in Bakersfield, California. You're on the air with Senator Sanders. James?
Hello?
Yes, sir. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, sir. You were talking about outsourcing. That is the biggest spending program that we have. It makes non-contributors out of contributors. And a guy a while ago talked about, it was just as much of a stimulus program, was just as much a Chinese stimulus program, or was an American stimulus program.
James, is there a question
about,
in there?
The biggest food stamp program, as far as I'm concerned, is a business luncheon. That costs the taxpayers far more than food stamps.
Well, you make two good points, James. I think, and let me begin to clear, I am an independent. I'm the independent senator from Vermont. And on this issue of outsourcing and on this issue of trade, I have to tell you, it is not just the Republicans. It is all of the Republicans, but it is Democrats as well. Let us not forget that it was Bill Clinton who signed NAFTA against my strong opposition and the opposition of working people throughout the country. The result has been, in the last 10 years, we have lost something like 55,000 factories, millions of good-paying jobs, not all of it attributable to trade. There are other factors as well, but a lot of it attributable to trade. And I personally believe you're not going to see the middle class grow. We're not going to see decent-paying jobs in this country until we reestablish, once again, a strong manufacturing sector where we are buying products in our stores made in the USA. That has got to be the demand. So I think very much that we have to rethink this disastrous trade policy, which has been one of the reasons why we have seen the standard of living for working families in decline in recent years. James also makes the point that there are a lot of write-offs that many of our business friends have, including their fancy lunches and so forth, and he makes a good point on that as well.
We'll be back with more of Senator Sanders answering your questions in our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie, right after this, 45 minutes past the hour, here on the Tom Hartman Program. Check out Senator Sanders' website at sanders.senate.gov. Ours is tomhartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit tomhartman.com for audio and video archives.
More of Brunch with Bernie in just a moment. Welcome back, indeed, or your TV. Here we are. It's the Tom Hartman Program, a Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls. And Lance in Loleta, California. Is that how you say it, Lance?
Yeah, I'm fine. How are you doing, Tom?
You're on the air with Bernie.
Yes, Senator? Huh?
Hello?
I'm sorry?
Yes, you are,
Lance.
Yeah, I'm a 78-year-old senior. And I've been wondering what the hell I can do to help. Even if it's put a bumper sticker on my car or something, anything. But I got an idea the other night. A song came to me I wrote in 10 minutes. I put it on my YouTube site, called it Republican Party. And obviously, it's a spoof, but it has some salient points. And one of the things in it, it poses a question, rhetorical as it is, I don't understand how a working class person, whatever gender, race, religion, whatever, can believe this man, Romney, and vote for him and all his fat cat cronies who just want to take the cream off the top and keep all the power there while keeping the middle class down and not even caring about people under that. And your views on that, sir?
Well, Lance, I agree with you, absolutely. Look, it shouldn't surprise us that dozens of billionaire families are contributing a whole lot of money into helping the Republicans and Romney during this campaign, because Romney represents their interest. More tax breaks for billionaires, easing up of environmental regulations so that companies can make more money by polluting, deregulating Wall Street and other large corporate interests. I can understand that billionaires support that agenda and those candidates. But I agree with you, Lance. I do not understand how any working person could vote for a candidate who wants to move toward the privatization of Social Security, who wants to transform Medicare into a voucher program, who wants to make massive cuts in Medicaid and education and nutrition programs, all of which tens of millions of Americans absolutely depend upon. So for the billionaires out there, and all of those billionaires who are listening to this program, I can understand why you want to support Mr. Romney and the other Republican leaders. But for any working person to be voting for somebody who says, yeah, we need more unfettered free trade, make it easier for companies to ship your jobs to China. Yeah, make it harder for workers to form a union. Yeah, make it harder for low-income kids to be able to get nutrition programs. That I do not understand. And those people are simply voting against their own best interests, and I hope as few as possible will do that.
John in Folsom, California. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Senator, I wish there were more like you in Congress.
Thank you, John.
My point I'd like to make today is about the Democrats and how every election cycle we scurry together to get votes and get our people in office, where you got to hand it to the Republicans. They started grassroots movements back in the 80s during Ronald Reagan's administration. They loaded up school boards, city councils, county commissioners, city government, and that's who they draw from. That's where Paul Ryan came from. And I just think the Democrats, or what I would like to say is progressive thinking people, need to be more active all the time, 24/7, 365. And then we wouldn't have to scurry and sweat out these elections, because there's a lot more of us than there are of them.
John, I couldn't agree with you more, and thank you very, very much for that right-on statement. I think you hit the nail right on the head. What Republicans do understand better than Democrats. Democrats spend a whole lot of money, run like crazy 2 months before an election. But what John is saying is Republicans are at it 365 days a year. And I'll tell you what else, what John didn't mention. What Republicans are doing is focusing a whole lot on the media. We are very lucky to have great talk show hosts like Tom Hartman, Ed Schultz, and others. We have a lot. But the truth of the matter is, and I always forget this number, Tom, what is well over 90% of talk radio is dominated by extreme right wing. Is that right?
Yeah, it's or it could be even worse than that. If you look at actual number of programming hours, it's probably closer to 95%. Yes.
All right. And Democrats have got to be supportive of progressive radio. You know, why is it that Republicans have the Fox television network and Democrats haven't created anything? So I think John hits the nail right on the head. What politics is about is not just getting involved 2 months before an election. It's involved. It means being involved in educating and organizing 365 days a year. And I'll tell you something else, which disturbs me. Democrats, to a significant degree, do not have a 50-state strategy. My fellow Vermonter, Howard Dean, who used to be the chairman of the Democratic National Committee, said Democrats should be competing in all 50 states. You may not win tomorrow, but you're never going to win unless you plant the flag, bring people together, start coming forward with good candidates, do grassroots organizing. Democrats have abdicated a large part of this country. And I think that that's wrong. So the main point that John is making is that politics is 24/7. It is 365 days a year. It means being on the school board. It means being on the city council. It means demanding that media present all sides of the story. That's what being a responsible citizen is about. And we are not doing that anywhere near the degree that we should.
Very well said. Bernie, we have just, 30 seconds? Just a few seconds left. Your final thoughts for the day?
All right. Let me just take people back to a point I've made before. Pay attention not only in the next couple of weeks, obviously, before the election. Pay attention to what happens in Washington after the election. A lot of discussion on deficit reduction. There are virtually all Republicans and some Democrats who want to do deficit reduction by cutting Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, veterans' needs, etc. We must not allow them to get away with that. There are ways to do deficit reduction by asking the wealthy and large corporations to start paying their fair share of taxes and taking a hard look at military spending. We can do deficit reduction in a way that is fair, not attacking the most vulnerable.
Bernie, thanks so much for being with us again today.
Okay, Tom. See you later.
Have a great day. We'll be back. Senator Sherrod Brown will be with us in just a few minutes.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Anything Goes Friday. Senator Brown is going to drop in at the bottom of the hour and say hello. But in the meantime, the lines are open. You know, there's a lot going on. Romney's in-law problem is starting to get some attention. His wife's brother, Roderick Davies, and two of his wife's closest relatives, both Utah-based businessmen. We're having some significant, shall we say, business problems, and now they're kind of turning those things around with the, this from Yahoo News, this story. Romney's campaign would not discuss his efforts, but through interviews and public records, ABC News has found ample evidence, this is actually from ABC News via Yahoo, has found ample evidence that the presidential candidate made repeated efforts to assist them. And they go into the Wall Street Journal and all this kind of stuff. And then secondly, there's this closely held equity fund called Solomir. We talked about this yesterday. Mitt Romney and his wife, son, brother, major investors through Solomir. Solomir is the company that his son Tag started with $10 million from his dad. And Solomir is a big investor in HIG Capital. HIG Capital, in turn, holds a majority share. This from an article by Bob Petrakis and Harvey Wasserman over in the Free Press. HIG, in turn, holds a majority share and 3 out of 5 board seats on Hart Inner Civic, a company that owns the notoriously faulty electronic voting machines that are going to count the ballots in Ohio. Yeah, you heard that right. Romney's son invested in the company. This is fully a third of HIG's leadership previously worked at Romney's old firm, Bain, just to put a little icing on that cake. So anyhow, we'll pick up your calls and thoughts. Gary in Saranac Lake, New York. Hey, Gary, what's on your mind?
Listen, Tom, I had a question. It seems to me everybody's so focused on the long term, getting jobs back and our manufacturing back in the country. And we have such a proven track record of government programs back, you know, Roosevelt and things like the Civilian Construction Corps, the Work Projects Administration. It put people to work right away. It didn't matter what they did before. It put them to work.
Right.
It seemed to me that like it pulled our economy back.
Yeah, it did. I mean, Franklin Roosevelt got us out of the Great Depression with a moderate stimulus program, which was called the New Deal, and then a much larger stimulus program called World War II. And, those two massive efforts of government spending put America back to work and set the stage for 60 years of prosperity, which was then systematically dismantled by Reaganomics and 30 years of Reaganomics. So, it's kind of a no-brainer. The problem is that when Obama came into office, you know, they looked at what was going on with the recession, and they thought that it was like the recession of, you know, the Reagan recession, that you know, which was accompanied by the biggest stock, 27%, as I recall, drop in the stock market, the biggest single day drop in the stock market in the history of the United States since 1929, since the Great Depression. And, you know, that recession only lasted a couple of years. We bounced back fairly quickly from it. And, in fact, there's a really interesting piece in the New York Times today about how really that was caused by the early days of computerized trading. And now we are, like, you know, fully into computerized trading, so it's going to get even worse. But in any case, you know, they looked at that and they thought, okay, you know, if we just produce a reasonable stimulus, you know, $1 trillion are in that neighborhood, we'll get out of this thing in 2 or 3 years, and by the time the next election comes around, everything will be fine. They genuinely believed that, and they didn't have, you know, that much evidence. I mean, there were some people out there who were saying, no, this is the real deal. This is the big depression. You need a $3 trillion bailout, not a $1 trillion bailout. But you know, the best minds in the Obama administration, Lawrence Summers and Tim Geithner and these guys, Jared Bernstein in the vice president's office put together the stimulus package. They thought that it wasn't as bad as it was. And it took them, you know, 6-8 months to realize how bad it was. The stimulus did stop the hemorrhaging. But by the time they realized how bad it was, Senator Brown had been sworn into office in Massachusetts. Thus, you know, I mean, the Democrats only had a veto proof or a filibuster proof majority in the United States Senate for 2 months and one day. Out of the entire 3 years of the Obama presidency, these Republicans keep running around going, he hasn't done anything. He controlled both the House and Senate for 2 years. No, 2 months and one day.
Exactly.
And then Senator Brown got sworn in, not Sherrod Brown, but, you know, Cranky Brown. Say what, Shane? Yeah, Scott Brown, excuse me. And I've got Sherrod Brown on my mind. He's going to be on the show in a little bit. But Scott Brown, the Republican, and boom, you know, they couldn't get any more stimulus through. They couldn't do a WPA or a CCC or any variation on it, even though it was increasingly obvious that we need that. A year ago, the president put forward a jobs bill, which was a small variation on a WPA. It was, you know, there's all this work that needs to be done in public lands, and it genuinely needs to be done. And so let's hire people to do it. And by putting those people to work, those are jobs that are not going to go off to China. Those people, putting those people to work or anywhere else, you know, you're going to stimulate the economy. The Republicans, you know, they refused to even consider it in the House of Representatives, and in the Senate, you know, they put a hold on it. So it's like, you know,
and back then it didn't matter who you were. You needed a job. It didn't matter where you worked before. These people were Americans. They saw America failing.
That's
they
right.
Wanted to bring us back. You know, and today I think that programs like that would work.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, Gary, and very well said. Thank you for calling and saying it. And in fact, the reason why it's not being done is you can track right back to January 20th, 2009, when 14 Republican leaders in Congress and Newt Gingrich and Frank Luntz sat down at a private dinner the night that Obama was sworn in as president. And Paul Ryan was one of them. And basically swore a blood oath to each other to defeat any efforts by the president to stop the economy from being in free fall. And, you know, other than that 2 months and one day that the president had a filibuster-proof Senate, the Republicans have been pretty successful in blocking any efforts to improve the economy. And that's, the basis of the Romney campaign. Look at this economy. It stinks. Blame it on Obama. No, I'm sorry. Blame it on the Republicans. Bob. In Renton, Washington. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hey, Tom, thanks for taking my call. I was going to talk to you about the third party, and I always felt that Ralph Nader duped a lot of people.
Well, I think in 2004...
And I'd like to tell you why I feel he duped a lot of people.
Go for it.
Well, look at Elizabeth Warren. She's a very effective consumer advocate, is she not?
She certainly is.
And she's running for senator position. Correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Now, you tell me what position that Ralph Nader ran for other than the presidency. And I don't think that you can because he never did.
Yeah, you're right.
If he was really serious
about
being an effective elected leader, he could have moved to California and ran the seventh largest economy on the planet, but he never did. He's never ran for a governor. He never ran for senator. And he never ran for a congressman. but he was going to run for the president.
Well, let me push back on this, Bob. Ralph Nader's run for the presidency in 2000. I didn't support his run for the presidency in 2004, and I had him on this program, and we discussed it, and you know why I didn't. But in 2000, I thought having him on the ticket or on the ballot was a useful thing, because what he was doing effectively was bringing up issues that were not being brought up by the Democrats and the Republicans. Issues of consumer protection, issues of international trade. He was saying things that needed to be said. And the Green Party continues to do that. And I'm sure there's people on the right who think the same is true of the Libertarian Party. In fact, I'll say that's true of the Libertarian Party with regard to things like, you know, decriminalizing pot. But I don't think that Ralph Nader was seriously running for president. He knew that there was zero chance he would become president. What he was doing was taking the largest, basically, PR platform that was available to him, and it was there and it was available to him, and using it to try to change the public discourse in America. And I think, frankly, he did. I think he played some small role in that. So I supported his run in 2000, and like I said, I didn't in 2004. He didn't have the Green Party endorsement. David Cobb ran instead, and David was running a strategic campaign saying, you know, if you're in a swing state, vote for the Democrat. We'll be back 15 minutes past the hour. Vote for John Kerry.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And I think that strategic perspective is a wise and smart one. Stick around. Anything Goes Friday. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, man, interesting times, right? Very interesting times we live in. Joe, listening on AM760.com in South Glens Falls, New York. Hey, Joe, what's on your mind today?
Hi there.
Hi. What's up?
Yeah, I'm calling to get a little encouragement. I'm kind of a fresh convert to progressivism.
Okay.
And I'm kind of I'm an unlikely convert. I was a faithful listener to Rush Limbaugh for years. In my own personal life, I'm a conservative Christian that has kind of followed that line of things for many years. And you know, I've kind of broken through that and seen the attractiveness of the...
Well, let me suggest to you, Joe, that if you consider yourself a Christian, you know, the very, probably the most famous liberal in the world was Jesus Christ. Read the Beatitudes.
More and more.
Read Matthew 25. I mean, you know, the disciples came to him and said, how do we get into heaven? And he said, in the last days, I'll be judging the sheep and the goats, you know, deciding who goes to hell and who goes to heaven. And he says, and I'll send... You know, the people who fed me when I was hungry, who gave me water when I was thirsty, who clothed me when I was naked or sheltered me when I was homeless, who healed me when I was sick, and who visited me in prison when I was in prison, those people will go to heaven with me. And the disciples were horrified because they'd never seen him hungry or thirsty. They said, oh, no, we're screwed. What are we going to do? And Jesus said, as you do to the least of these, my brethren, you have done unto me. That is the original liberal statement. So,
and capitalism, when you think about it, really doesn't fit too well in the Gospels.
No, no, generally not.
It's probably the least suspect, or the most suspect thing you want to fool around with.
At least laissez-faire capitalism, at least completely unregulated capitalism. I think that a capitalism that has a conscience, you know, Jesus at another time, you know, I think it was a centurion came to him and said, you know, or somebody came to him and said, you know, should I pay taxes? And Jesus said, you know, whose face is on your coin? And he said, Caesar's. And he says, you know, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and unto God what is God's. In other words, you know, it's okay to participate in the real world and be spiritual at the same time. And, you know, not to try and turn this into the old time gospel hour here, but the point is that I think that capitalism can be run in a way that is compassionate and does comport with religious values of all the world's major religions, and or simply decency, you know, the common decency, the atheist values even. But anyhow, I'm guessing that's not where you were going with this. Pardon my interrupting.
Well, no, I think where I'm at right now is, you know, we're just a couple weeks from the election, and, you know, I'm posting my growth on Facebook and my friends and family are thinking I've fallen off the cliff. And, you know, I'm like finding myself really mostly excited and attracted more and more to the Green Party and Jill Stein.
Mm.
But then I've got Democrat friends telling me, listen, you're wasting your vote, you know. And I know what that's all about. When I was a Republican, you know, I'm still a Republican, but when I was voting on that side, you know, many times you held your nose and you voted. And, you know, I guess I'm
this is not looking. Yeah, Joe, I got it. And thanks for the call. I would say this is not a hold your nose election. You know, there's a lot of really there's a lot of really good reasons to vote for Barack Obama. Now, you can always find some things to complain about. In fact, you know, there's a reasonable list with any politician. You know, you can find things to complain about with Jill Stein, for that matter. It's just, you know, they're typically not the things that get talked about. But I would say this is not an election where I would be personally, where I would be going down that road. I intend to vote for Obama and, you know, whatever. John in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, John, what's up?
Yeah, I understand that you talked about this issue yesterday, but I found out this week that apparently Mitt Romney offshored from the deal with the auto companies, Delco specifically, he made anywhere from, they say, $15 million to over $100 million, and he put it in a blind trust, and that's one of the reasons why he doesn't really want to release the information, because I think that would come out, and I wish that Barack Obama would address that, because Greg Palast, who released this story, has a lot of very credible support for that issue, yeah. You know, and if that
Greg's
is
a good
indeed
reporter.
True, which I think it is, he not only ripped off the American people by, you know, literally, I guess, would be billions of dollars, because he went in with Paul Singer, who is also funding is the biggest contributor to his election. But there were three other people, and they offshored it to the Channel Islands, to Jersey, not New Jersey, but Jersey.
Mm-hmm. Right, off the coast
of England. It's just amazing, because what happened was the federal government wanted to save those Delco jobs. That was 25,000 jobs offshored with the help of Mitt Romney.
Right.
This needs to be addressed. I think he is the biggest hypocrite that we have ever put forth in my lifetime.
Well, here's an example of how insane it is, John. In the last presidential debate, at one point in the debate, Romney said, if I'm elected president, I will create 12 million jobs in the next 4 years. Remember that?
Yes.
Remember how he ended the debate? Government doesn't create jobs?
Yes,
he's saying on the one hand,
I watch the debates.
Right. He's saying on the one hand, if I'm president, I'll create 12 million jobs. And then on the other hand, he says, government doesn't create jobs. Oh, but he's going to criticize the current president. It's like Mitt Romney has no moral compass other than making profit. And personally, I think being loyal to his church. I think he's loyal to his church and his family, and he's loyal to the profit motive. And that's it. His political standing, his political positions have changed so many times. And I don't think he not only cares about, but frankly, I don't think he has an understanding of the life of middle class working people, and particularly the working poor and the poor who are out of work. I don't think he has a clue. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. Sherrod Brown is going to drop by to say hi, and then we'll be picking up more of your calls for the rest of the day. Topic of your choice. Anything Goes Friday. Have you been over to Amazon.com and seen the Avery Durable View Binder with 2-inch easy turn ring, white one binder, item number 17032? There's hundreds of reviews for this binder saying things like, yes, you heard it right. I had 5 women in my binder in just one day. And afterward, all the men left, but not before safely securing me into my binder. This is written by a woman. Here's another one. Maybe it's just my women, but they don't seem to want to fit into the space I've designated for them in this binder. They keep sticking out over the edges, even getting away in some cases. I thought using clear glass ceiling page protectors would help, but it doesn't seem to slow them down anymore. I'm going to have to resort to more severe three-hole punching to keep my women in line and maybe switch to the trapper keeper type of binder. And then here's another one. For a first-time buyer like myself, I would have to say I would rather have waited until I had accumulated a few women before investing in a binder. Just a little warning for prospective buyers. In fact, there's one comment that says, be careful. This does not come with women included. Thank you so much. Here's another one. Thank you so much, Mr. Romney, for letting me know that all I needed to get a job is to be in this binder. This is from a woman who published this. Another one. My male boss wants to know if this binder comes in pink. He says he wants to be able to find a particular binder very quickly at times and that a pink binder would be so helpful. It just goes on and on. I mean, it's hysterical. Romney's binders full of women. Yes, indeed. Hang on just a second here. Senator Sherrod Brown is on the line with us. Senator Brown, welcome back.
How are you? Sorry about being a minute late.
That's quite all right.
I didn't get to hear your newscast on through the phone tonight.
Well, and in fact, Shane was going to play Eva Destruction for you as our bumper.
We got to be on again in the next week or so.
There you go.
I want to hear it.
Got to do it.
My daughter was so excited because I've made them listen to that. My daughters are 28 and 31. I've made them listen to that song and talk to them about the historical context of Selma, Alabama, and Red China and the Cultural Revolution and all that. And it's a teaching moment. They're always teaching moments, Tom,
they're
so good at.
They really are. So, Senator Brown, the last time we talked, we're talking with Senator Sherrod Brown. His website is sherrodbrown.com, of course, the Democratic senator from the great state of Ohio. The last time we talked, Karl Rove, the Chamber of Commerce, and various right-wing wackadoodles had poured something like $19 million into the state to support this rather lame guy who's running against you. How's it going now?
They keep adding to it. They did. Karl Rove bought another, one of his groups bought another $800,000. They're up to $24 million. I mean, it really is about, it's $24 million in attack ads. And it's, the cynicism of this, on the one hand, they're trying to suppress the vote by, really trying to exclude low-income people and people with less education from voting and the elderly poor from voting. And at the same time, they're trying to buy elections so they can get rid of the estate tax and they can weaken environmental laws and they can evade labor law. And that's how they want a country with only educated, affluent people voting. And they want a country where with very low tax rates and no environmental rules to speak of and weak labor laws. And that looks more like Brazil or a poorer country than it does our country. And we've had a lot of progress for a lot of years, and we're not going back. That's why we're going to win in the end.
Yes, third world America seems to be the vision of these billionaires. It's almost like something out of a Dickens novel.
It's stunning that they don't, that the far right and these billionaires and the oil men and women, I mean, not many women, oil men, really believe they're better off if everybody else is poor, when most of us understand, I mean, look at the Clinton years, a whole lot of people got really rich, but so did most of the rest of the country. And I don't care if people get rich, as long as people that are working class, like my wife, had a chance, because her dad carried a union card for 35 years at a utility plant in Ashtabula, Ohio, she got a chance to go to Kent State. And she did well, and her brothers and sisters all got to go to college first in their family. And that, why would you not want that kind of a country? I don't get it. I don't even understand these people that these, as Chuck Schumer calls them, economic royalists, that they think that way.
Yeah, the economic royalists. Oh, excuse me. You got that clip, Shana? The economic royalists is one of my favorite phrases. It really began with Franklin Roosevelt, and he. Anyhow, I don't want to. I don't want. Yeah, it's a 30-second clip. I'd rather hear from you.
I can hear from me anytime. I'd rather hear the clip.
Okay, well, here, just take a quick listen to this.
Thanks.
These economic royalists complain that we seek to overthrow the institutions of America. What they really complain of is that we seek to take away their power and our allegiance to American institutions. Requires the overthrow of this kind of power.
There you go. That's
good. Isn't it?
Franklin Roosevelt taking names and kicking butt.
So not only is that good, but how did you know? How did you? Did your staff get that so quickly after I used that?
Oh, Shane's a genius. You know, he's a genius.
Was that the 36th convention? When was that? 36th?
That was the 1936 convention. That was his acceptance speech, July 27, 1936, in Philadelphia, as I recall. And
you recall, were you there, Tom?
No, I actually, in one of my books, Unequal Protection, the book about how corporations became people, I reprinted that entire speech in the book.
Okay.
And I have big chunks of that speech memorized. So I'm there's a few areas where I can just pull these things out and seem amazing,
July,
but you know it's
day,
not.
July what, 26?
My recollection was it was July 27, 1936, okay. But I could be off by a few days.
Okay.
Shane is going to Google this right now, but it was Franklin Roosevelt's acceptance speech for his second nomination for president, and the entire speech is one of the most brilliant. I mean, from beginning to end, there's not a sentence I take out of it. It's one of the most brilliant things I've ever read.
And the public kind of bought what he said too, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. Yeah, he won in a landslide
that year.
Yeah, he won in a landslide.
My recollection is, again, without being there like you weren't, but that the first time a candidate ever addressed a political convention was Roosevelt in 1932.
I think that's
correct, although you will have listeners that will immediately correct me, so I take that back.
I know,
not true, but I thought I remember reading that.
June 20th.
Anyway, I know of that speech, but I don't know the details.
Okay, Shane says it's June 26th. He's 27th. Oh, okay. He checked the Google machine. So June 27th, 1936.
Cool.
Yeah. So we're in the, I think we've got a couple minutes left here before we hit the break. Where are you going with your campaign? What are the things that you're finding as you're traveling around Ohio? We're talking with Senator Sherrod Brown, sherrodbrown.com, the website. What are the things that you're finding that really are getting people excited, that they want to hear from you and that they want to hear from other members of Congress?
Well, they want to hear the contrast. My opponent says in every speech that Sherrod Brown's most liberal senator in Washington, and that includes he's a member of the same body as Bernie Sanders, a self-avowed socialist. That's sort of his standard phrase.
Mm-hmm.
And the public in Ohio wants to, in the end, they don't think left or right. They don't think liberal conservative or progressive conservative. They think, whose side are you on? And we just make that contrast on everything from women's health to the auto rescue to the environment to standing up on China on fair trade. To tax cuts versus focus on the middle class on every issue. It's whose side are you on? And there's hardly a state in the country that doesn't take the progressive side of those questions.
Yeah.
Most people are very supportive of women's health issues. Most people are very supportive of fair trade. Most people are very supportive of Medicare that not voucherized, privatized, turn it over to insurance companies, Medicare, but Medicare that guarantees a benefit that people paid into their whole working lives. You make that contrast, clearly you win elections, whether it's Ohio or Florida or Nebraska.
Yeah, and Bernie's doing a great job in Vermont. I lived
Vermont,
there for a decade,
exactly right.
And it's amazing, the Northeast Kingdom that is very, very poor.
Yep.
And you drive in the election of 2000, Louise and I would drive around the Northeast Kingdom and see in people's front yards, in a trailer, with a sign out that says, we sharpen chainsaws, and that's what they do for a living, and they're living on $8,000 or $10,000 a year, and there would be a Bush sign out in front and a Bernie sign out in front, Bernie for Congress and Georgia. It's just amazing that people get it, that when a member of Congress, somebody like yourself, really cares about their issues, about their pocketbook issues, and is really fighting for them, that person is going to make things happen. And people can support that effort and find out what you're up to. Get over to SherrodBrown.com. Senator Brown, after the election, any thoughts on, the days? I mean, the days immediately after election, this whole fiscal cliff thing, what's going to be going on, the lame duck session, what are your thoughts about that?
Well, a number of thoughts that are probably too much for this show today, but my first thought is that you don't let them use this as an excuse to go after the public programs that we fought for 75 years. I mean, Social Security's worked since the first payment in 1940. Medicare's worked since 1965 when President Johnson signed it and went into effect the next year. Those are guaranteed programs. They're social insurance. They shouldn't be privatized. They shouldn't be cut
just because people say everybody's got to sacrifice equally, or, I mean, there's going to be changes in those two programs, but they can never lose their underlying purpose of being public programs for the public and having the universal political support they have. That's fundamental to me. I know there'll be changes, but we're not raising the retirement age because people that work in Congress may not worry about people that do physical labor and can't work till they're 70, but there are certain, to me, incontrovertible and inviolable parts of those programs, and the universal nature of it is fundamental, both
yeah.
of them.
Yeah, it is.
Let's start with that.
Absolutely, and there's already an effort, and it's being funded aggressively by billionaires here in Washington, D.C., to say, oh, we need to cut Social Security and Medicare, and it's good to know that people like you are going to stand as a firewall against that. Senator Sherrod Brown, Sherrod Brown, SHERRODBROWN.com, the website. Thank you, sir.
Thank you always, Tom.
Thanks for being with us, and thanks for the great work you're doing. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And it's Anything Goes Friday, back with your calls on your topics, my topics, the news of the day, right after this.
I read the news today, oh boy.
I got her.
About a lucky man.
Well, let's check the news. This Talk Radio News Service report brought to you by the efforts to free America's newest political prisoner, former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman. You can sign the petition asking President Obama to pardon Don Siegelman at free-don.org. Check it out. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
It's been a while since I've heard your voice. It's always nice to hear your smiling voice. What's in the news today?
Well, here's a Jeopardy question.
Uh-oh.
Political Jeopardy.
Uh-huh.
What, within an hour, became a top trending term worldwide today? That would be Romnesia.
Romnesia. There you go.
The
inability to hold a political position for more than, what, 20 minutes?
Pretty much. This, of course, is the term that President Obama came up with today at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia, where he spoke to an estimated crowd of 9,000 about Mitt Romney and mocked him for his recent efforts to appeal to centrist voters, saying he's forgetting what his own positions are and he's betting you would too. And then he went on to list the symptoms of this condition. I think it's called Romnesia, kind of like you might be a redneck if.
Mm-hmm.
And after he'd gone through it, saying you need to get a thermometer, take your temperature, because you might have Romnesia.
Uh-huh.
Ultimately, it's by saying if you come down with it and you can't remember all these policies you've had on your website and you've had for 6 years, there's good news. Obamacare covers pre-existing conditions.
Ha! That's great.
We can fix you up. We've got a cure. We can make you well, Virginia. This is a curable disease.
Romnesia, treatable with Obamacare. That's brilliant. That is brilliant.
So it's something that's being taken quite seriously in a sense, because even though the Romney campaign said that this was him Dean screaming his way through his speech, people are seeing it as a bit more serious than that, because it is portraying Romney not so much as a flip-flopper, but more as somebody really who can't be trusted on matters that matter to women in particular, who will say whatever he has to say to advance his own ambitions.
Right. And it, you know, I mean, this was the hit. I remember CPAC 4 years ago. I was there. You were there. And remember the guy walking around in the flipper outfit?
Never forget it.
Yeah, Flipper the Dolphin and all the people with the giant flippers on their hands and things. I mean, these were the anti-Romney conservatives. And I I'm surprised that there hasn't that flip-flop word that got so, so attached to John Kerry, so inappropriately, frankly. But, you know, the Republicans did a very good job of attaching that to him in the 2004 election. That phrase, that word has not been attached to Romney. I think Romnesia may do it. So anyhow, what else is going on in the world?
Well, one more piece of Mitt Romney news. Of course, newspaper endorsements are coming out now. The Tampa Bay Tribune unhesitatingly supported President Obama. And the Salt Lake Tribune came out with its endorsement today. The Salt Lake Tribune, of course, here in Utah, and endorsed President Obama.
You're kidding.
No.
The major paper in Salt Lake City, the epicenter of the Mormon world, endorsed Obama?
Yes. Saying that Mitt Romney was its favorite son, but said that it was not the Mitt Romney that they knew.
Huh.
Referred to his servile courtship of the Tea Party to win the nomination, and now as the party's shape-shifting nominee. Said Romney is shameless, lavishing vastly diverse audiences with words, any words they would trade their votes to hear.
Wow.
It is an excoriation.
That's
of
amazing.
Mitt Romney.
It's and basically a description of Romnesia.
It is.
A quick
it
question
is.
Here, Victoria. You've got your finger to the pulse of the news business. In the debate last week, Romney, you know, this young man asked about getting a job out of college, and Romney said, "If I get elected president, I'll hire you. I'll get you a job." Isn't it a federal crime to offer something of value in exchange for a vote?
Indeed, I believe it is. You're better on these things than I am, but I believe it is.
Has anybody been talking about this in the news
media
that Romney might have committed a federal felony right in front of all of us?
No, because everybody's caught up with Candy Crowley being a suicide bomber or acts of terror.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, right.
That's what the entire 90 minutes has boiled down to now.
Well, that's, you know, if your candidate loses, blame it on the moderator. And I mean, there was a certain amount of that, you know, going after Jim Lehrer, you know, when Obama turned in a bad performance. But, you know, come on.
I mean, the substance of the debate, what I thought was some of the strongest part of the debate was the closing statements of both candidates, which I thought were really quite interesting, not being talked about at all. So very, very interesting.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Agreed.
Also today, in less good news for the president, top House Republicans are demanding information from the White House on the September 11th assault on the Benghazi diplomatic mission and accusing the administration of reducing security to dangerous and ineffective levels. This, of course, coming from Representative Daryl Issa, House Government Reform Committee, and Jason Chaffetz.
Now, do you know if Daryl Issa voted along with Paul Ryan to cut the security budget for the State Department for those embassies?
I hesitate to make a guess.
Mm.
My guess would be that he did.
Yeah.
It would be astonishing that he voted in the other direction.
Right.
It's a 10-page letter.
Huh.
Asked Obama to answer 11 questions about the decision to remove security personnel from Libya and how deeply the National Security Council was involved. The letter also says the White House, quote, has not been straightforward with the American people in the aftermath of the attack. Which, if I can editorialize for a minute, is interesting. If you're asking Obama to answer 11 questions, why are you also making a statement that they haven't been straightforward before you get the answers to your 11 questions? And I'll end my editorial right
there. And this, the easy answer is because it's a political stunt. And it raises the question, if a Democrat had been president on 9/11, had been president when 9/11 happened, you know, would there have been that bipartisanship that we saw with a Republican president where the Democrats said, we're all Americans now? Given the way Daryl Issa is behaving, I suspect not. But in any case, Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
And check out free-don.org.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Anything Goes Friday. The Tom Hartman Program. Bill in Princeton Junction, New Jersey. Bill, what's on your mind today? Oh, hang on just a minute. You know what? No wonder I'm not hearing. Bill, hang on just a half a second here.
Hello?
I forgot to plug myself in. There you go. So, Bill, what's on your mind?
I'm just going to let you know that they're buying your vote in a different way. That is Americans for Prosperity. They're running an event in Lower Merion Township in Pennsylvania, $1.84 a gallon for gas. It's going to run for 2 hours, and they're showing the prices under Clinton, under Bush, and then with Obama, and they're blaming the gas rise on, of course, the Obama administration.
Right. It's a political stunt, obviously, but nothing surprises me. Thanks for the heads up on that, Bill.
It's taken it to a different level.
Yeah, it's downright offensive. Bill, thanks a lot for the call. And the president addressed that in the debate. Rick, as a matter of fact, the price of gas is about where it was right now during Bush, during the leading up to the election. But when the bottom fell out of the market, the price of gas dropped as well. Rick in Las Vegas. Rick, you're on the air. What's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. I wonder if you could answer a question about all the voter restriction that's going on in the country now, and there's been many different ways it's been proven that it's happened. Why is it that the federal authorities aren't doing anything about it? They know what's going on.
Oh, they are. The Justice Department has filed a whole bunch of different things. They're challenging many of these voter ID laws. These voter suppression photo ID laws. They're prosecuting some of these, or investigating anyway, some of these guys. The thing is, what the Republicans know, and you've seen this before, you saw this in the election of 2004 in Ohio, is if they can pull off a fraud and get away with it and win the election and continue to hold the state and hold the White House, then they know that they'll get away with it. There's going to be no investigation. And that's why, the crime of 2000 down in Florida, the crime of 2004 in Ohio, and thank you for the call, Rick, for raising this topic. Lyndon Johnson. I mean, let us not forget Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon. In 1968, Lyndon Johnson was president. The Vietnam War was about halfway through, right? The Vietnam War was going. Hubert Humphrey was vice president of the United States, former senator from Minnesota, and he was running for president. And in the election of 68, Humphrey was actually a very popular guy. The war on poverty was spectacularly successful. And Humphrey had a good chance of winning. The albatross around his neck was the war in Vietnam. And at that point, Lyndon Johnson knew the war was a total horrible mistake. And so he had negotiated peace between the North and the South. And the U.S. was going to pull their forces out, and it was all going to work, and it was going to be announced in the fall of 1968. They negotiated that throughout 68. And it was the election, the force of the election, and young people like me in the streets that was pushing him to do that. They had a deal. And it would have guaranteed that Humphrey would have been president. Not that he wasn't already ahead. And so Richard Nixon's people down in New Mexico, on behalf of Nixon, reached out to Madam Tu, the leader of South Vietnam, reached out and said, don't go to Paris. Don't do the peace deal. We'll give you a better deal. And Lyndon Johnson called up Everett Dirksen, the head of the Republicans in the Senate, one of the most respected senators, frankly, in my lifetime, a good man. This was back in the days when Republicans could be good men and women. Called up Everett Dirksen and basically said, I'm reading their hand, Ev. I'm looking at what's going on. We got the cables here. The CIA intercepts these things, right? And here's this guy. This is treason. And Everett Dirksen at the very end says, yep, it is. And we didn't know this as Americans, that in 1968, Richard Nixon committed treason to become president of the United States. That these are the games Republicans have been playing for two generations now. We didn't know this until just 2 years ago when the LBJ Library finally made these tapes public, and we were able to listen to this conversation between President of the United States Lyndon Johnson and Republican Senate Leader Everett Dirksen.
Here's the latest information we got. The agent says that they just talked to the boss in New Mexico. And that he says that you must hold out. Just hold on until after the election. We know what Chu is saying to them out there.
Yeah.
We're pretty well informed on both ends. Now, I'm reading their hand, Everett. I don't want to get this in the campaign.
That's right.
And they oughtn't to be doing this. This is treason.
I know.
This is treason. I know. And, later in the conversation, Everett Dirksen says he will go and he will talk to Richard Nixon and he'll try to get him to stop doing this. And, of course, it was not successful. Nixon successfully sabotaged the peace talks. Just like I believe that Reagan's campaign, Bill Casey, who is running Reagan's campaign, successfully sabotaged Jimmy Carter's efforts to get the hostages out of Iran, which cost Carter the election. It was the exact same playbook. And now you got Daryl Issa trying to do the exact same thing with these guys who died in Benghazi. Hey, let's turn an international incident into an opportunity to embarrass a sitting president. That's treason. You say, what, are you accusing Daryl Issa of treason? Damn close to it. Just go back and listen to those tapes. You can find, you know, the Johnson Library is, you know, this is not some, you know, liberal think tank. This is just the library of a president. And the tapes are all there. You can, what I just played for you is just one of them. We've got a couple. Don't we have any more of those? Okay. They have been chopped up into little pieces. So, you know, I don't want to bore you with the whole thing. You got the essence of it. In any case, it's out there. So, Michael in Dublin, Virginia. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, how are you today?
I'm great, but I'll get better, Michael. How about you?
Oh, yes, I feel good. I feel good. Now, listen to this, and I want to say that our presidency has been sabotaged. Our government has been sabotaged. And we know right now that war is being discussed secretly behind closed doors. War is being discussed.
War is always being discussed. We are the last empire on earth. We hold the position right now that the Great Britain did going into World War One, and you know they lost that empire. And frankly, in retrospect, it was a good thing for their country. And I think that it wouldn't be a bad thing if much of America's position of the world empire were to contract somewhat, as Ron Paul suggests, as George Washington suggested. Let's avoid some of these foreign entanglements.
Right. And now they are called the economic royalists. Absolutely. Listen to this. Let me get to my point, Tom. Thanks a lot. Let me get to my point that on February 23, 1871, the 41st Congress passed the law, a document that replaced, that created a government separate from the United States, a government separate just for D.C. It's called an act to provide a government for the District of Columbia. This is a separate document they created from the Constitution for the Americas.
Michael, you've been on too many conspiracy sites. This was an attempt to allow, up until that point in time, if my understanding of this may be incorrect, but this was not an attempt to say, okay, we're going to create a parallel government that's going to run the country. The problem was that up until that time, the District of Columbia, which had been carved out of the United States as a separate district that would be administered by Congress, this was the district of the goddess, right? Columbia is the name of the goddess that the founders came up with for America. She's on top of the Capitol building. She was on our coins. That really what this was about was simply saying, okay, Congress doesn't want to run D.C. anymore, so we're going to allow for a mayor and a city council and all those kind of things. We're going to create a government like any city would have, although this is a unique city because, you know, it should be a state, but it's not. So, Michael, I think that that's what it's all about. Thanks for the call, though. Feel free if you think I'm wrong, let me know.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
But I really don't think there's a shadow government outside of the billionaires, the transnational corporations, and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Yeah, express yourself here on Anything Goes Friday. By the way, I'm going to be in Chicago next Tuesday. What is that, 4 days hence, thereabouts? Doing my show from the studios of WCPT, or at least the first 2 hours of the show. And I hope you'll join me that evening as the Free and Equal Foundation presents the third-party presidential candidates debate at the Hilton Hotel's International Ballroom. That's at 720 South Michigan Avenue in downtown Chicago. Dr. Jill Stein of the Green Party, Gary Johnson of the Libertarian Party, Rocky Anderson of the Justice Department, Virgil Good of the Constitution Party will be on hand. And for more information and to purchase tickets, you can go to freeandequal.org. That should be interesting. It should be very interesting. Michael, in Imperial Beach, California, watching us on Free Speech TV. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind?
How you doing, Mr. Hartman? Well, since there's really going to be no viable third party on the horizon shortly, and we're stuck with two parties, I got an interesting concept for you.
Okay.
What if we run the presidential race like the Olympics? The winner gets the gold, the presidency. The loser gets the silver, the vice presidency. But then they would have to be president and vice president. Wouldn't that make both parties have to deal with each other? And do you think that'd be beneficial or detrimental?
Well, that was the original Constitution. And that's how it worked. Whoever got the most electoral votes was president. Whoever got the second most was vice president. And you know, it wasn't so much of a problem in the George Washington administration. But then when John Adams ran for president against Thomas Jefferson, Jefferson came in second. And so Jefferson was vice president and hated John Adams. And, when John Adams signed the Alien and Sedition Acts in 1798, Thomas Jefferson left town in protest. I mean, they were not speaking to each other at the end. And in fact, in the election of 1800, when Jefferson beat Adams finally and in the Electoral College, there was some considerable discussion. I mean, not just a little bit of gossip. I mean, there was a serious contingent of Americans who were going to fight to keep John Adams in the White House, even though he had lost to President Jefferson. And others who were preparing to defend President Jefferson, which is why that election for most of the 19th century and part of the 20th century, and it was referred to as the Revolution of 1800, and because it was a major turning point in America. You know, John Adams was a very conservative, radical conservative by today's definitions, politician, almost fascistic in my opinion, and Thomas Jefferson was a very, very progressive and somewhat libertarian president. I mean, they were like night and day, these two guys, and they didn't speak for years and years. It was like, in the 1820s, I think it was 1823 or something like that. It was 20 years after that election, the election of 1800, that finally, and as I recall, it was Ben Rush, who was a physician and a friend of both of theirs, might have been somebody else, but this is my recollection from having read the story years ago. Got them together in correspondence, and they started this correspondence, and these series of letters back and forth between Jefferson and Adams in their final 3 or 4 years of their lives. They both died on the same day within a few hours of each other on the 4th of July. And those letters are just beautiful reading.
How can a presidential candidate run on the fact that he made an Olympics go successful? To me, that's just crazy. Whatever.
Well, here's the thing about that. Thank you, Michael. Here's the thing about that. The Olympics is a government-sponsored program. The guy, you know, when Mitt Romney took over the Olympics, the first thing he did was get a bigger budget for it. It's like, what? What? Somehow, you know, it's hard for Democrats to bring that up, and the Republicans are not going to, you know, I mean, they were running around with their flipper outfits 4 years ago, but they're not doing it now. John in Rochester, New York. Hey, John, what's on your mind?
Yeah, hi, Tom. Good to hear from you. What I wanted to ask, and I'm a little confused, and maybe you can fix it for me. What is the definition of small business? Is it based on how many people or how much money?
It depends on who you're asking. If you're asking the Small Business Administration, it is, I believe, under 500 employees and under a certain number of millions of dollars a year. If you're asking the Internal Revenue Service, a small business is a company that files a tax form as a pass-through partnership. In other words, the company is wholly owned by one entity or one family or a small group of investors, and by holding the company in that way, some part of the company's income is represented as their income and shows up on their income tax return. In that context, the Koch brothers... Well, for example, several of the Koch brothers' enterprises are considered small businesses, even though they're huge. They're billion-dollar enterprises. I believe that Bechtel, I may be wrong, but the largest construction company in the world is considered a small business by those definitions. In 97%, you have these dueling small business definitions between, for example, Obama and Romney. And Romney is talking about, you're going to raise taxes on small businessmen. Well, he's talking about the Koch brothers and Stephen Bechtel and people like that. And Obama's saying, well, 97% of small businesses would not see their taxes increase. That's because, 97% of small businesses are actually small businesses. and 3% of them are these giant corporations that are using the tax code to basically shelter their income. So, John, that's the problem. You can do some Googling on this, I'm guessing. Diane in Lansing, Michigan. Hey, Diane, we got a minute to the break. Quick one.
Hi, Tom. Well, I would like you to remind everyone the importance of collective bargaining. You know what's on our ballot this year, Proposal 2.
Proposal 2 in the state of Michigan?
Yes.
This is to put into the Constitution collective bargaining, is it not?
Yes.
To make this so that Rick Snyder is the governor of Michigan, that he can't pull a Scott Walker. I get my Scotts mixed up and my Ricks mixed up. It's like they're all and ban collective bargaining. Yes. So if you're living in Michigan, Prop 2, pay attention to it. Okay? Okay. Diane, thank you very much for calling and making that point. Collective bargaining, frankly, should be in our Constitution. You know, when the Wagner Act was passed in 1935, it was a law, the National Labor Relations Act. It was a law. And, you know, then in 19—so what did the Republicans do? They say, well, we'll write a law that reverses the law. And in 1947, they passed Taft-Hartley. They reversed the Wagner Act. That's no good. I mean, we should get this into the federal Constitution, that there is a right to collectively bargain. You have a right to be a member of a union. You have a right to have democracy in the workplace. I mean, they do in Germany. It's part of their Constitution.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
At the suggestion of Harry Truman, I might add. They do in Germany, as with their national health care program. But it works just fine for them. Today's show is underwritten by my favorite investigative reporter, Greg Palast, and his new bestseller, Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, How to Steal an Election in 9 Easy Steps. Greg Palast investigates Karl Rove, the Koch gang, and their buck buddies. Check it out. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Jim in Scappoose, Oregon. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind? Thanks for listening to KPIJ.
Yeah, I'd like to explain why windmills work so much better over water. 70% of power in Denmark from windmills.
Yeah, and it's coming out of Copenhagen Harbor. I've been there. I've seen them.
Well, the first reason is there's no obstructions to the windmills at sea.
Yep.
When you have it on land, it obstructs the wind.
Right. So there's no turbulence to the wind.
Yeah, second, when it's off the coast, especially like along the Atlantic coast or the Pacific Northwest, the wind averages over 25 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And if it averages more than 25 miles an hour, you're getting 100%
right
out of a windmill. And third, there's no power lines. One of the main obstructions to windmills is across land is people don't want power lines running across their property. You don't have to have eminent domain.
Right. They just lay them on the seabed and you know, bring them up buried.
And the fourth reason, they say that the wind doesn't blow all the time. But if you group them, like, you know, let's say along the East Coast,
mm-hmm.
and then interconnect them, as the weather system moves through, you get power 100% of the time. Because usually the weather moves along the East Coast.
That's
so interconnected.
Yeah.
Interconnected, you're producing power all the time.
Right, right. And then it's just a matter of, you know, how do you store it during times of minimal demand for times of peak demand? And there's all kinds of options there, ranging from hydrogen to what they're doing in Denmark, where they're underwriting the cost of manufacturing electric cars, and people can charge their cars at night by buying very cheap electricity, and then during the day they drive to work and they plug it in at work and they sell that electricity from their battery back into the system, keeping enough in the car to drive home that night, and thus they're, you know, you get a million cars and they become, you know, with batteries in them, and they become basically a giant storage system for the grid. And we discussed this at some length with several of the politicians and engineers who were putting this thing together when we did our show from Copenhagen about 2 years ago. So excellent point, Jim. Thanks for calling and making it. Very, very well said. Kay in Austin, Texas. Hey, Kay, what's on your mind?
Hi. I wanted to propose the idea that I had that you talked about treason in past elections. And I suspect that the conservatives may have been involved in the 9/11 situation in Libya recently for political reasons. And I was going to get your idea or your thoughts on that.
I would be very surprised. I would be very surprised. I, you know, there's a town near Benghazi where they're, you know, basically the town has been taken over for some time by Al-Qaeda type crackpots. And apparently that's where these guys came from, and you know, and did this dastardly deed, and I mean that literally, and you know, in retrospect, we probably should have had better security, or for that matter, Ambassador Stevens shouldn't have been. This was not an embassy. This was just a compound. I mean, this was like a consulate. It was a remote office. He shouldn't have been there. Certainly not on 9/11. He should have been at the main embassy in Tripoli. And when he wrote in his diary that he was looking for more security, it was for the main embassy in Tripoli. It wasn't for Benghazi. So, the extent to which you could pin any of this on Republicans, if that was your goal, you know, certainly Darrell Issa and his buddies, the Republicans in Congress, are trying to pin blame for it on President Obama. But if you wanted to try and flip it around, is that Paul Ryan and Darrell Issa voted to cut the number, the amount of money, the amount of funding for the Department of State for their security services. And, in fact, you printed that out for me, didn't you, Shana? Oh. Okay. So, anyhow, take Shane's word for it. It's over at the blog of another program, but you can check it out. Thanks a lot, Kay, for the call. Luke, in St. Charles, Illinois, what's on your mind, Luke?
Hi. How are you?
Good. What's on your mind?
I'm here to talk about, because I kind of have an interesting perspective on this election. This election is very, 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 very important to me,
mm-hmm.
personally,
mm-hmm.
To the point where I sometimes lose sleep over it at night. And all this worry is simply because of the consequences of Romney being elected, and some of the things that he says really, really worry me. To begin, I'm homosexual, which is fun and cool and great, but Romney finds that rather disagreeable, which is annoying. And I keep hearing about him. I hear two conflicting things, which I want clarified. I hear that on the one hand, he wants to put in a constitutional amendment to the federal constitution prohibiting gay marriage in any state. And on the other hand, I hear one where he wants to help reverse anti-discrimination laws based on sexual orientation.
Right.
Do you know his stance on any of those issues?
His stance right now, I'm not sure on any issue. You know, Romney has Romnesia, and it's a real problem because he doesn't remember the positions that he took, you know, just last week or last month or 6 months ago. What I think could safely be said is that women's rights, gay rights, any kind of minority group in the United States, the rights of any kind of minority group in this country are at risk in a Republican presidency or a Romney presidency in particular, because he's going to be putting more right wingers on the bench. He's going to be, you know, advocating for more of these right-wing, hardcore, harsh laws, and he's going to elevate into positions of power more of these right-wing, so-called Christian conservatives, fundamentalists, who you know, want to try and pray away the gay or whatever. I'd be very concerned about that.
His religion also comes into that, because if you do a little research on Utah, the Mormon Church is either the second or number one contributor into things dismantling civil rights for homosexuals.
Yeah, they were big funders of the effort to end gay rights in California. The largest single donor. And the church's position is fairly straightforward on that. Although, you know, in their defense, that's the case with many churches, probably most churches. Although I think that that's something that's changing very quickly. Go ahead.
And then that's just one reason to lose sleep. The other one is Romney's view on education, because I remember I heard Romney say that he believes Americans should get the education which they can afford. Now,
right.
My dad abandoned us during my freshman year of high school and took his finances with him. So my mom is supporting three children on waitress's fund income.
Mm-hmm.
So I cannot afford a huge amount of education. In fact, I calculated it out, and, you know, I'll probably be able to afford 2 years of ECC and perhaps 2 years of a community college and then going to a university, which is good and all, but that's not my goal. See, like, what I want to do is I want to get a doctorate in mathematics and another degree in physics and work as a nuclear researcher.
Mm-hmm.
but I won't under, you know, under an administration that says, that removes federal loans and grants and says that, you know, you will get what you can afford. I can get a beautiful job as a welder or perhaps a pipe fitter.
Yeah.
Which isn't what I, where I want to be. I mean, last year I taught my, I created my own calculus course and taught myself calculus within the context of physics. I do not, it is unfair for me to be doomed to weld things.
Right, which is not to say that there's anything wrong with welding things for people who want to weld things, but you want to be a physicist. I get it. And, you know, in my lifetime, I mean, when I was a kid, the University of California system, well, you're calling from Illinois. I don't know what the situation was in Illinois, but in California, it was free. Education was free. Ronald Reagan put an end to that. And in many states, it was free. And if, where it wasn't free, it was so cheap that, I mean, you talk about your mom waitress salary. My wife, Louise, put herself through college by being a waitress at a Howard Johnson's. I mean, literally on tips, you know, rode her bicycle to work every day. And that's how it used to be. That, I mean, back in the late 60s. It's very different now. It's very expensive now, in part because of this effort to privatize education, in part because everybody's out to make a buck off the thing, in part because, you know, the student loan business is a huge one, and the banksters are in on it. So these are all things that we need to be paying attention to. I think that, Obama wants to expand Pell Grants. Romney wants to reduce Pell Grants. His white paper was quite clear about that. So there's a clear choice there. Luke, thanks for the call. It's pretty straightforward stuff. Liz in West Hollywood, California. Minute to the break. Liz, what's up?
Hi. I had a question about Ryan's his involvement in the caucus room event, where he swore allegiance. Didn't he already swear allegiance to the Constitution of the United States?
Well, and to Grover Norquist.
Are they in conflict, and wouldn't he be considered a traitor to the country?
Well, when I say these guys swore a blood oath, that's a bit of hyperbole. I mean, they didn't cut their wrists and put them on each other,
that,
you know. But here's what they did say in their own words, okay? The National Journal, Congressman Pete Sessions, who was in that meeting, he said, Taliban insurgency. We understand perhaps a little more because of the Taliban. Insurgency is the way they went about systematically understanding how to disrupt and change a person's entire processes. And these Taliban is an example of how you go about changing a person from their message to their operations, to their frontline message. And we need to understand that insurgency may be required when dealing with the other side, talking about the Democratic Party. He went on to say, if the Democrats do not give us these options or opportunities, then we will become the insurgency. I think insurgency is a mindset. Congressman Kevin McCarthy said, we got to challenge them on every single bill, show united and unyielding opposition to the president's economic policies. Verbatim quotes. By the way, these guys all voted yes to the Bush-Cheney bailouts of Bear Stearns, AIG, the 2008 TARP, and the second Bush-Cheney TARP. So, Liz, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I mean, it's really quite remarkable when you look at it. These guys, they were, you know, hey, let's support the Bush administration. Obama, no. We're going to do everything we can to crash the American economy.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to our executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producer, Shane Farnan, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, our phone screener, Danielle Gilday, to writer-researcher Sam Sachs, to Alva Goldbook for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, every one of our syndicators, the various companies that put us out there and provide us to radio stations and television stations, Dial Global, commercial radio stations, Pacifica Radio and non-commercial stations, Free Speech TV on Dish Network, DirecTV, all the cable providers who carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, all the others around the country, to all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on the big picture, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, and the folks in our chat room, hey, to Ellen Ratner, Victoria Jones, and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. And it means a lot. Thank you. Thank you very much. Larry, in Opelika, Alabama. Am I saying that right, Larry?
Yeah, you're close, Tom. Opelika, yep.
Okay. Great.
Appreciate everything. Tom, is there any downside for these super PACs, either financially, well, I guess specifically financially, for their candidate if they lose? They invest a lot of money. We know what they get if the candidate wins. What happens if they lose?
Well, they've lost the money. And
okay.
And there's also the possibility of prosecution of some of them. The Karl Rove's groups in particular, some of them are not actually run as super PACs. They're run as charitable organizations or educational organizations. And the IRS code is pretty specific about you can't engage in electioneering if you're doing that. And so they say that in their ads, well, we're just attacking the president over an issue. We're not actually talking about a candidate. And I think that, you know, when these things are litigated, which will probably be over the next year or two, that they're going to lose a lot of those cases. They're going to be facing some large fines. And probably what they'll do is they'll just bankrupt the organizations and move on. But there is, I think there is some liability there, and it's one of the reasons why it took the Democrats such a long time to jump in and come up with their own super PAC.
They don't get a giant write-off, for example.
Not to the best of my knowledge, no. I don't think so.
Okay,
no.
Well, good. I appreciate it. Thanks for everything, Tom.
Thanks a lot, Larry. I appreciate the call. Mark in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Mark says you disagree with me.
Hey, Tom.
On what? Say what?
One second. Hello?
Yeah,
hello?
You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Fine. What's up?
I was calling about a caller a few callers back about the school loans and not being able to afford schooling.
Well,
and
his point was wrong.
I just graduated that.
Go ahead. Go ahead. Never mind.
And I just graduated from a school in Pennsylvania in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm faced with some school loans and whatnot, but you can afford just about any school you want to go to with loans, grants, scholarships. So if
you can get somebody to co-sign the loan. I mean, this guy might not have had the ability to do that.
I didn't have anybody to co-sign the loan either.
Well, you know, good on you, Mark. I can tell you from my own personal experience, one of my kids needed to get a loan to get, you know, through nursing school, and she was unable to qualify for it personally. And so I co-signed the note, but she wouldn't have gotten the loan without that.
What about scholarships? You can get a scholarship for being left-handed.
Well, she's actually now working on her PhD on a full scholarship, there are not that many scholarships as there are scholars, Mark. It's just a very, very simple reality. If you want there to be as many scholarships as there are scholars, then let's go back to the program we had before Ronald Reagan was governor of California and have, you know, the state educational systems be free to everybody. Everybody gets a scholarship if they qualify to get it. You know, if they can pass the entrance exams to get into college, then they get to go for free. It was Abraham Lincoln's idea, by the way. Actually, it was Thomas Jefferson's idea. He came up with it. He created the University of Virginia. It was the first free college in the history of the United States. Totally free. Jefferson wanted it that way, and it was that way until the day he died. And then Abraham Lincoln came along, and he said, you know, we got all this land after the Civil War. We got all this land. Let's grant large tracts of land to individual states so that they can not only build universities on that land, but they can also use that land to produce revenue to support those universities, these land-grant colleges, so that people can go to college for free. So in some cases, it was forest land that could be, you know, you harvest the trees periodically. In other cases, it was farmland that was actually worked by the university. Michigan State University has this whole, you know, giant farming thing going on out there. As a result of the land, it was a land-grant college. Abraham Lincoln set that thing up. Let's go back to those ideas. Malcolm in Park Forest, Illinois. Hey, Malcolm, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Good.
Listen, I'm hopping mad about Romney and this. It's alleged that he has been involved in buying an electronic voting machine company.
Well, not him. His son's investment company apparently is invested in funds that are invested in these voting machines. But there's a number of people on the board of one of the voting machine companies. Apparently, they're former Bain Capital people. So, yeah, it's starting to smell pretty fishy.
Yeah, I think the Justice Department should look into that because I remember Al Gore, the machine counted 6,000 of his votes backwards.
Yeah, well, it's not just Al Gore. I mean, this
6,000, but that would have been more than enough to put him over the top to win Florida. So,
yeah.
And also, the chairman of the board of Debo sent Bush a letter, and that has been on the internet, guaranteeing him that he would win Ohio.
Yeah, although that was Wally O'Dell was his name, and basically what he was saying is, you know, I'm a good Republican. He was a fundraising letter to other Republicans in Ohio saying, you know, I'm committed to delivering Ohio for President Bush, and I'd like your help. It was not necessarily as sinister as it seems, but the fact, here's the big issue, Malcolm. It's not whether these voting machine companies are stealing our election. I mean, we can debate that. It is that our vote has been privatized in the first place. That's the crime against democracy. Of all the parts of our commons that should never have been privatized, the vote, which is the part that controls all the rest of the commons, is the most important. Malcolm, thank you for the call. Thanks for listening to WCPT. It's always great to hear from you. Coming up next, third and final presidential debate, this time in Boca Raton, Florida, with moderator Bob Schieffer. Is he going to be in control, or is he going to be a potted plant? We'll have a preview on Monday, plus the best of the rest of the news and your calls. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag. You're it. Occupy something. See you on Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.